Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Henry M. Willis for appellants in this matter. We would like to reserve 4 minutes for reply at the end of the argument this afternoon.
So I'm assuming that's coming off your time?
Off of my time.
All right.
I would take it off of the other side's time, but I don't think.
No, but I mean, don't you have co-counsel that's arguing?
No, that's the appellant.
Oh, okay. All right.
At any rate, Your Honor, this case boils down to a single question of contract of plan interpretation. Namely, does the plan provide in clear and express terms for the vesting, the contractual vesting of a right to disability retirement benefits? Now, there are three things that aren't in dispute. First, disability retirement benefits never vest as a matter of law under the statute, under ERISA. Second, Supreme Court held in M&G Polymers that contractual vesting, something that's over and above what the statute requires, is possible, but only if the plan provides for that in clear and express terms.
So, counsel, what case are you relying upon to support the argument that contractual benefits only vest if it's clear and explicit in the contract?
In the plan, that would be M&G Polymers, Your Honor, to the extent that it followed it, CNH thereafter. But essentially, it's M&G Polymers where this was discussed at some length. The court...
Counsel, are you saying then if a provision is ambiguous, there can never be any vesting?
There can never be contractual vesting. Now, the statute itself provides for vesting of any number of benefits.
No, but I'm saying if the contract... language is ambiguous.
That's right,
it's
Your Honor.
Your position that the benefits can never vest.
That is, in fact, when the court in M&G referred to the rules, the traditional rules of contract interpretation, it singled out in that case the rule that in order to provide for contractual vesting, there must be clear and express language. Now, that serves as a gatekeeper, as it were. That means that if there isn't clear and express language, the other rules never come into play because the claim dies at that point.
And so, counsel, in your view, absent what you think is clear and unambiguous language, that no one can even ever resort to parole evidence?
That would it doesn't figure in this sort of case. That's right, Your Honor.
So you have a provision that would suggest vesting, but is not clear and unambiguous language, and the plan sends out notice with the plan, calling it a summary plan description that specifically says you are vested. If you have 10 years in, you will qualify for disability if you meet the other requirements like Social Security, and it can never ever go away, and that's what the plan says. That in terms of the contractual analysis, that's irrelevant because it's extrinsic.
There are two reasons for that, Your Honor. First, of course...
But first, your answer is yes.
Oh, my answer is yes. And there's two reasons for that, Your Honor. First of all, that once again, what the court said in M&G was clear as day. It must be clear and express for any possibility of contractual vesting. Secondly, the example, and it's certainly one that we... have heard the plaintiff offer of an SPD that appeared to promise vesting of some sort. Well, the problem with that is that the Supreme Court's decision in Cigna versus Amara tells us the SPD can't amend, can't modify the plan. It's the plan document that the court, that the trustees are bound to follow.
Well, but in traditional contract law, parole evidence is not used to amend, but to explain.
But in this case, in the absence, since this, the case law requires that any contractual vesting can only be established by clear and express language to that effect, that relying on an SPD to provide for vesting that where the plan doesn't would have the effect of amending the plan. We don't get to the ambiguity because the door is closed by the lack of clear and express language. And that's, I apologize, Your Honor, I don't want to preempt you.
No. Go ahead.
This is, in fact, it's not just a judge-made rule. This is a fundamental principle of ERISA itself. ERISA provides that the plan must follow, and the trustees who interpret the plan must follow the governing plan documents. Why do they do that? Well, part of it is for very concrete, practical reasons. A plan needs to be able, in order to deliver the benefits promised, it needs to be protected, as it were, from the unexpected, from landmines that could be...
Counsel, even if I were to agree with you about the law, I'm not saying I do, you're not suggesting that the normal rules of litigation don't apply. So I assume as to how we determine clear and unambiguous. And in the 30B6 deposition, there's a question, does the text under the heading, how you become vested, provide an accurate description of the pension plan's vesting provisions? And the answer was yes. And then there's another question. So the word vested is used in the SPD has a different meaning than non-forfeitable, correct? I think that's true. Is it your position that your client's 30B6 representative's testimony is not part of the calculus either?
Correct, Your Honor. The reason being that in order to go to extrinsic evidence, there has to be an ambiguity. But if there were an ambiguity...
But this isn't extrinsic evidence. Would you say that if you got a request for admission in the litigation, do you admit that the plan is clear and unambiguous and you admitted it? Yes. That nobody could rely on that either because that's extrinsic evidence as opposed to just the normal way litigation works?
It's extrinsic in this respect, Your Honor, which is to say the question about what the SPD means or doesn't mean is outside the four corners of the plan document itself.
But this wasn't a question about what the SPD means. The question that I read was, do these words provide an accurate description of the plan's vesting provisions?
And to that extent, we...
This court now resumes this session.
All right, thank you, counsel. Mr. Willis, could you please proceed?
You're muted.
Can't hear you, you're muted. I know. Mr. Willis, there you go.
I'm back. I apologize. Sign of age, I suppose. Your question as to role intrinsic evidence said in D goes directly to that point. What the court said is that in order to create contractual vesting, that is vesting of a benefit that isn't required by statute, the intent to vest must be found in the plan documents and must be stated in clear and express language. Now, we've relied heavily on the clear and express language part of that sentence because, in fact, since the court below found that the language was ambiguous, that is in and of itself enough to resolve this claim. But the other part...
Counsel, can you give me one example with your interpretation, one example of when the grandfather clause would actually kick in to grandfather somebody?
Certainly. The example that we cited in the... is if the fund were to, well, there are two examples. So I'll first use the one that's plausible, and then there's also one that's a little less. The first one is this fund uses what's called cliff vesting, which means that for your first 5 years of service, you can accumulate 5 years of vesting service. But until you hit the 5 year mark, they're all subject to being lost if you leave the industry, subject to break in service rules that are explained elsewhere. There's also graduated vesting that is an alternative allowed by the statute, in which you can start under the statutory scheme. You can start vesting at 3 years, but you do it as, or it's not an all or nothing proposition. You do it on a graduated basis. If the fund were for some reason to switch from cliff vesting to graduated vesting, or hypothetically, if were to do that, there would be hypothetically some people who might have more rights under as using the cliff vesting system than they would under graduated vesting. And of course, if you change the equation for a different hypothetical plan, obviously the statute, because this language all derives from ERISA, the statute would also allow those people in a case where a fund goes from graduated to cliff vesting, people that the 4 year mark would have the right to say, well, I still get to hold on to that percentage of
would that be so I understand you, would that be under ERISA no matter what the plan said?
The plan follows ERISA on this point.
So on that example, the grandfather clause is irrelevant because ERISA would provide that right.
The other example that I would offer is a little, as I said, a little more far-fetched. If ERISA were abolished, you'd still have a plan. If ERISA were, I
agree with the far-fetched part. So basically,
and that's why it's not a here and now situation. But nonetheless, in that case, then the contractual right to hold on to what you had would apply if the plan were to change its method of accrue of measuring vesting.
But in terms of normal retirement or disability retirement or early retirement, the grandfather clause provides no rights to anybody.
Well, the grandfather clause doesn't apply in disability or early retirement. It does apply to normal retirement because that's a benefit that's subject to vesting. The grandfather clause is, you could say, redundant in a sense because it follows what the statute provides. But nonetheless, it's on its own terms, it does protect those folks who might be affected if there was a change in plan terms. But that doesn't include disability retirement benefit claimants because as the language on which the plaintiff relies says, that when there's a change in the method of calculating vesting, or if there's a change in the vesting requirements or the vesting calculation, then that 1301 will protect those persons who want to use the old rules to obtain a vested benefit. But that is where the plaintiff's argument falters, because if disability retirement benefits aren't vested and the plaintiff does not claim that he's seeking a vested disability retirement benefit, if such disability retirement benefits never vest, then 1301 simply doesn't come into play. It wasn't intended for it to come into play, and it doesn't come into play. The only reason...
So you're down to a minute and 40 seconds. Did you want to save any time?
Oh, I did save time long ago, before everything went haywire. I think that's for 4 minutes.
No, but the time on the clock was your total time.
Oh, no, I think it was ratcheted down to 11 when we started.
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
Well, no, it was 15 minutes on there when you started.
Let me reserve the rest of my time because it's clear
that
the clock is
only... In all fairness, you've had extra time in any event.
I don't feel slighted.
Exactly.
I'd like to reserve 2 minutes, which may be more than
than
the clock tells me I have. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Garofalo, are you going first?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Joseph Garofalo, and I represent the appellee and cross-appellant Gary Romanchuk. My co-counsel, Bradford Ginder, is here for Mr. Romanchuk, and he has 3 minutes to address any estoppel issues or questions you may have. I wanted to start with responding to the appellant's argument that a clear and express standard applies. We're not talking about contractual non-forfeitability of a benefit. Every case that we look at either involves lifetime health benefits or some argument by a plaintiff that benefits are contractually non-forfeitable. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about an interpretation of an election provision that even if the election provision is satisfied, the participant still isn't, most participants, in fact, still wouldn't be entitled to the benefit because they'd have to meet another condition for eligibility. And therefore, none of the cases that apply a clear and express standard are applicable here because we're not talking about contractual non-forfeitability of a benefit. But even if we were applying a clear and express standard, my adversary is incorrect as a matter of law that you can't look to extrinsic evidence when there's an ambiguity in the plan. And that's made clear both in the Supreme Court decision of M&G Polymers v. Tackett, where the Supreme Court arguably applies something akin to a clear and express standard, but then talks about custom and usage evidence. And then also the concurrence, the four justice concurrence in Tackett explicitly talks about extrinsic evidence, even when a clear and express standard is the standard for a lifetime non-forfeitability of health benefits. The same is true in CNH versus Reese, another Supreme Court decision, where the court there rejects a inappropriate presumption that the appellate court had made, but still makes it clear you can resort to extrinsic evidence even when a clear and express standard is applicable. So we dispute that there's a clear and express standard that is applicable to this case at all. But on top of that, even if there were a clear and express standard, we could still meet that. And Judge Bennett's point about the deposition testimony and the normal rules of litigation, I think is a very strong point through the questioning. On the excerpts of record, there is no objection during the deposition colloquy that suggests that the question was inadmissible. There's no objection at all. And I'm on SCR 49 of the excerpts of record.
I don't think you need to. My recollection is the only objections you need to make during depositions are to the form of the question.
Correct. But here we're not asking an inadmissible question either, because we're asking how the trustees interpret the plan and the summary plan description. So we know that they've interpreted the plan in our favor to mean that that vested does not mean non-forfeitable. But I also want to directly attack Mr. Willis's example, because if you look at the plain language of the section 13.01, you can see that the last sentence is broken up into two clauses. You have the grandfather clause, and then you have the clause that precedes it that in pertinent part reads, no amendment may divest any accrued rights which is vested prior to the later of the date of execution of the amendment or its effective date. Mr. Willis's example, it renders that clause entirely superfluous, because you don't need to protect something that under Mr. Willis's parlance is already non-forfeitable. So his example renders that clause entirely superfluous.
Now, so that in your view, that once everybody in the plan hits 10 years, then the plan with this grandfather clause has no ability to, for them, increase the number of years they need to take advantage of disability if they object.
It certainly apply to those who reach 10 years, but it even provides an election provision. The grandfather clause, at least, provides an election plan for those who have 3 years. That's when it triggers, and then they need to meet additional requirements for additional benefits for the disability.
So absent the grandfather clause, would you agree you lose?
Yes, we are not making, well, other than the estoppel or some other cause of action, but for the benefit claim, the claim that the appellants have asserted, we would lose. We're not making a ERISA argument here that we're
okay. So to go to another issue, you've contended that there should be no abuse of discretion standard applied here, and I'm sort of at a loss to see how that would work in a circumstance where, I mean, your claim is the trustees didn't apply the grandfather clause, but you never raised the grandfather clause. So putting aside the issue of whose responsibility it is, why shouldn't the trustees have a shot at the grandfather clause in the first instance when you didn't raise it in the two appeals to the trustees?
Your Honor, because the grandfather clause was never disclosed in the primary vehicle to communicate rights and benefits.
I'm sorry, I don't understand that argument, because you had the plan, right?
No, not necessarily. The plan is not required by law to be distributed to participants and beneficiaries. The only document that's required to be automatically distributed to participants and beneficiaries is the summary plan description. So,
did you aver, and I just don't recall this, did you aver in the district court that neither your client nor you at the time of the appeals or prior counsel, I don't know which counsel it was, actually had the plan?
No, we didn't. Well, I don't believe that we did, but the issue is that it's their burden to demonstrate an abuse of discretion standard of review rather than a de novo standard of review for the plan administrator. And Abatey, the en banc Ninth Circuit, says that there needs to be two conditions to have abuse of discretion standard applicable. First, the plan needs to grant discretion, which there's no dispute here. But second, the plan administrator or other responsible fiduciary needs to exercise that discretion. So it would be their, our position would be, it'd be their burden to demonstrate why Mr. Romanchuk shouldn't have raised the argument about the grandfather clause. And our response to that is, well, we never received the summary plan description. And on top of that, the summary plan description does not even contain any mention of the grandfather.
Mr. Garofalo, if it seems undisputed that the trustees never considered the grandfather clause, and you did not respond to the argument, the defendant's argument in a footnote, granted, about Vizcayano, which is another Ninth Circuit en banc decision that says we shouldn't be lured into taking the place of the trustees. If they haven't interpreted it, we shouldn't do it in the first instance. So why shouldn't this be remanded to the trustees to interpret the grandfather clause in the first instance? We don't even have their interpretation to apply any sort of abuse of discretion or de novo or any other kind of review.
Judge Beatty, 2 points in that regard. First, you're referring to Vizcayano v. Microsoft, the en banc Ninth Circuit decision, and that didn't involve the failure of the plan fiduciary to disclose the relevant provision. That just involved a new issue of plan interpretation. As far as I can tell from the case, there was no allegation of an egregious ERISA breach. And on top of that, we do have an interpretation by the 30B6 witness of the trustees that vested does not mean non-forfeitable in litigation. So it's not
as... that's a bit of a stretch, isn't it? I mean, the trustees are an official body. You don't have them making any kind of decision. And Vizcayano says we should not allow ourselves to be seduced into making a decision which belongs to the plan administrator in the first instance. So I don't understand your distinction. We don't have the plan administrator's interpretation of 1301. How do we do that in the first instance?
Well, and again, I think it goes back to distinguishing Vizcayano, that there was no issue of a failure to disclose the relevant provision to the participant and beneficiary.
But how does that change whether the trustees or the plan administrator has an interpretation? They do or they don't, and whether... You know, they didn't disclose it to you, so that's your excuse for not raising it in the two administrative appeals. But we still don't have an interpretation.
Right, but they're not, Your Honor, entitled to an automatic right to interpret. They need to have the discretion in the plan, and on top of that, they need to make an interpretation. And I would go back to this case being in
Counsel, I want to make sure I understood what you said in response to my question. I think you answered it, but but I want to make sure I understood it. You said you have not claimed in the litigation that you didn't have the plan, right, at the time of the appeals?
It's not pleaded one way or the other whether or not we had.
So you, nobody on your side submitted a declaration that said we had no idea, we didn't have the plan when we did the appeals?
Not to my recollection did we submit.
Okay, thank you.
We didn't have the plan. Judge Beatty, I want to make sure that I have fully answered your question. In order to have an abuse of discretion standard of review, it's not an automatic right. It's actually, if you look back to the Supreme Court's decision of Firestone v. Brutsch, they have to have the discretion and then exercise it. And our position is that they forfeited that by not complying with ERISA. Your Honor, I wanted to make one more point about a concession that the district court recognized that the trustees made during summary judgment briefing. The district court indicated that the trustees had conceded that amendment number 15, increasing the vesting requirements, was targeted at a change to the quote unquote vesting requirement. And the district court held that at ER 21, lines 11 through 17. And the district court was correct. And once you concede that there is a, that amendment number 15 is targeted as a vesting requirement, that should be dispositive. On top of that, the district court was correct because the trustees at page 34 of the supplemental excerpts of record on lines 20 through 21 make that concession. So the district court was correct. And once you determine that it's a target to the vesting requirement, it falls squarely within the grandfather clause, Your Honors.
Counsel, you've exceeded your time. Are there any other questions?
No,
it appears not. Counsel, do you have any final thoughts? Because opposing counsel did get extra time. So if you have any closing thoughts you'd like to leave us with.
Yes, Your Honor. We are advocating for a interpretation of a clause that is a interpretation based on the plain language of the plan. And if you find that the plan is ambiguous, any extrinsic evidence should be dispositive, including the summary plan description and the summary of material modifications. And we don't even need to reach a de novo standard of review because the summary plan description and the summary of material modifications ought to be dispositive. So for the reasons that I've argued today and for those set forth in our briefs, the district court's remand order should be reversed and the court should rule that the grandfather clause entitles Mr. Romanchuk to elect to have his disability retirement benefit determined under the pre-amendment plan.
Judge Rawlinson, if it's all right, I apologize, but I do have, based on what counsel said, one more question, if that's
all right.
So, counsel, I'm not sure that I understand your argument about how the SMM example helps you. So I understand your argument about how the summary helps you, but I'm not sure I understand how the example at SER 121, example one, helps you. So could you run through that for me?
Absolutely, Your Honor. We're talking about the summary of material modifications, like you said, at SER 121. And if you look at on SER 121, example one, it states explicitly that vesting requirement after December 1, 2012. And if you compare that to the language of the grandfather clause, which is on SER 177, it explicitly references a vesting requirement. So once you...
Although counsel, the reason that I'm not quite following you is because under this example, even though Jim in the example had more than 10, this goes on to say that with the new plan description, he is not eligible for disability retirement because he didn't have 20. So isn't this exactly what happened to your client?
It is, but the problem with this example is the trustees say they've never considered the grandfather clause, but what this shows is that the change from 10 years to 20 years of vesting credits as a condition of eligibility is a change to the vesting requirement. And if you compare that to the language of the grandfather clause, the grandfather clause says any amendment changing vesting requirements. So therefore, it establishes that when the trustees look at this objectively, the change of amendment number 15 is targeted at a change to the vesting requirement. And once it's a change to a vesting requirement, then you would have to define vesting requirement differently than vested rights. So the definition, if you were to adopt Mr. Willis's interpretation, the definition of vesting would have to be different than the definition of vested as in vested rights in the very same clause, which is obviously unreasonable. You can't have a different definition depending on the tense of the word in the same clause.
I understand your argument, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, counsel. Mr. Gander? You're muted.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm Brad Gender, and I will be addressing the equitable belief claim. The appellants request this court to reverse the order denying their motion for summary judgment for equitable relief without citing authority to do so. There is none. In their reply brief, they cite two cases at page 27 that are not applicable because those cases rely upon 28 U.S.C. 1292. However, the order here denying the motion for summary judgment is not one of those types of orders addressed by that statute. We have looked for cases and have found none that confer authority to review a denial of a motion for summary judgment on estoppel under either 1291 or 1292. But if this court were to exercise jurisdiction, the district court's order should be affirmed. The evidence shows that with correct information, Mr. Romachuk could have and would be receiving today disability retirement benefits without changing the plan, with or without the grandfather clause. If the grandfather clause were not in the plan, correct information by the plan representative, Ms. Bibbs, would have been, Mr. Romachuk, you've got to work another 150 hours next year. And if you have questions, you should see the union representative about your options. And she told the appeals committee that in her opinion, by knowing him, he would have asked the options. The correct information the appeals committee should have provided after hearing from Mr. Romachuk on his appeal that he would have worked another few years to attain his 20th year, if he had known of the change requirement, would have included application of the Social Security 9-month trial work period to allow him to work the extra couple weeks to get the benefit. However, the appeals committee misinterpreted Social Security regulations and concluded incorrectly that they had no power to assist Mr. Romachuk in perfecting his claim because he had relied upon Ms. Bibbs to get a Social Security determination, and they thought they were handcuffed. That's wrong. And it supports equitable estoppel as well as surcharge as asserted in the our brief at page 57. If I may address the ambiguity, it should be measured under the objective standard. And for reasons already discussed today, there is ambiguity in the plan because it contains 1301. And a reasonable person could read that and read the application or amendment and conclude that it applies. Indeed, that's all required to find ambiguity, as the district court did. Ms. Bibbs' advice to Mr. Romachuk was consistent with such an interpretation. Therefore, Mr. Romachuk is entitled to go to trial if at the moment remand, or if your courts determine that he is not entitled to the benefit under 1301 directly. Thank you,
Your Honor. All right, thank you, counsel. 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be as brief as possible. First, as to the importance of allowing the trustees and indirectly the bargaining parties, the settlors, to deal with this issue, this case is, in fact, an illustration of why that's required. The changes that were made in disability retirement benefits in 2012 were the result of the financial meltdown of 2008. The bargaining parties directed the trustees to take action by a certain date if they were unable to get enough relief from the IRS to avoid the need to cut benefits. They were unable to get the relief. They made the changes at the command of the bargaining parties. It was, and when they made those changes, they did not consider the possibility of these surprise claims coming up by someone who argues that he's entitled to rights under the grandfather clause. Secondly, going back to what the Supreme Court said in M&G, it did, and there was a split between the majority and the concurrence. But the majority, which had 5 votes, held that the clear and express standard applies. They also found other grounds to rely on. That was necessary to get the 4 to concur. Same thing happened with the per curiam decision in CNH. They didn't revisit the 5-4 split over the clear and express standard, but it disposed of the appeal on the terms, on the plaintiff's own terms, by dealing with the defects in the plaintiff's claim, the assumptions, the son of yard man assumptions that the plaintiffs were relying on. It by no means represents any weakening, much less rejection of the clear and express standard, which the majority in M&G applied. As for the estoppel issue, I'll just say that first, unfortunately, the evidence is such that while Mr. Romanchuk wanted to go back to work at Gelson's consistently rejected him. It's doubtful that a different interpretation of, if he had been told correctly, you need 20 years, it's doubtful that he would have been able to make the 150 hours because Gelson's wouldn't give him the accommodations he says he'd asked for. He asked for them, they rejected. And the more fundamental problem with the estoppel claim is, of course, that it seeks to substitute 10 for, he's asking for the court to give him 10 years instead of 20. That simply can't be done. The Ninth Circuit, again, returns to the position. Benefit plans, for good or bad, pension plans and other plans, must adhere to the terms of the written document, the written plan documents.
Counsel, you've exceeded your time, but I wanted to ask you, yes. Do you agree with Judge Beatty that it would be prudential for us to remand this matter for the committee to look at the grandfather clause and see if that would change the outcome in this case?
We think it would be appropriate to do that if the court were to, obviously we're arguing for a different result on appeal, but we have no objection to remand to the trustees for that purpose.
So I thought your position was the grandfather clause doesn't even come into play.
It still is, Your Honor, but we can put this before the trustees.
All right. Any questions? Other questions from the panel?
So, Mr. Willis, I have a question for you. Would the trustees take the same position that counsel have taken in litigation and interpreting the grandfather clause?
Well, Your Honor, this case has we've had discussions with the trustees about this case, all privileged, of course. I can't say how the trustees. And it's a body that shifts from time to time. That is to say, it's not the same board that it was 2 or 3 years ago. I don't have the authority to speak for them on that point. how they would decide the issue when it was put before them. If in effect reopening for a third time the appeal process.
Counsel, do the trustees have the authority to award benefits based on some sort of estoppel type of theory, or do they lack that authority?
Well, on that, Your Honor, if the facts match the legal requirements, yes, they. I know that sounds like a hedge, but as a general rule, the trustees can't willy-nilly. There are standards that must be applied. I put it.
So theoretically, the trustees could say, in the abstract, the grandfather clause doesn't apply, but given the facts as we find them to be, we're still going to award disability benefits to this one individual, even if that won't benefit others in the putative class.
That's certainly possible, Your Honor. I mean, I will put it this way, that I don't want to, since I'm not a voting member of that body, I don't want to speak for it, but that is certainly possible.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you to all counsel, and thank you for your forbearance as we work through our technical issues. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court, and we are adjourned.
Thank you, Your Honor.
This court for this session stands adjourned.